something about our next day's itinerary. He found me on my hands and knees, searching for my contact lenses in a pool of my own sick. "Phil, you okay?" "Follow your mentor's lead," I mumbled. That morning we flew to Taipei, the capital, and toured a couple more factories. In the evening we strolled Shinsheng South Road, with its dozens of shrines and temples, churches and mosques. The road to heaven, locals called it. Indeed, I told Gorman, Shinsheng means new life. When we returned to our hotel, I got a strange and unexpected phone call. Jerry Shea was paying his respects. I'd met Shea before, in one of the shoe factories I'd visited the year before. He was working for Mitsubishi and the great Jonas Center. He'd impressed me with his intensity and work ethic. Youth. Unlike other shoe dogs, he was young, 20-something, and looked even younger, like an overgrown teenager. He said he'd heard we were in the country. Then, like a CIA operative, he added, "I know why you are here." He invited us to visit him in his office, an invitation that seemed to indicate he was now working for himself, not Mitsubishi. I wrote down Shea's office address and grabbed Gorman. The concierge at our hotel drew us a map, which proved useless. Shea's office was in an unmapped part of the city, the worst part. Gorman and I walked down a series of unmarked lanes, up a series of unnumbered alleys. "Do you see a street sign? I can barely see the street." We must have gotten lost a dozen times. Finally, there it was, a stout building of old red brick. Inside, we found a precarious staircase. The handrail came off in our hands as we walked up to the third floor, and each stone step had a deep indentation from contact with a million shoes. "Enter," Shea shouted when we knocked. We found him sitting in the middle of a room that looked like the nest of a giant rat. Everywhere we looked were shoes and more shoes and piles of shoe pieces, soles and laces and tongues. Shea jumped to his feet, cleared a space for us to sit. He offered us tea. Then, while the water boiled, he began educating us. "Did you know that every country in the world has many, many customs and superstitions about shoes?" He grabbed a shoe from a shelf, held it before our faces. "Did you know that in China, when man marries woman, they throw red shoes on the roof to make sure all goes well on wedding night?" He rotated the shoe in the scant daylight that managed to fight through the grime on his windows. He told us which factory it came from, why he thought it was well made, how it could have been made better. "Did you know that in many countries when someone starts on a journey, it's actually good luck to throw a shoe at them?" He grabbed another shoe, extended it like Hamlet holding Yorick's skull. He identified its provenance, told us why it was poorly made, why it would soon fall apart, then tossed it aside with disdain. "The difference from one shoe to another," he said, 9 times out of 10, "is the factory. Forget design, forget color, forget all the other things that go into a shoe. It's all about factories. Factories, factories, factories." I listened closely and took notes, like Gorman on the plane, though the whole time I was thinking, it's a performance. He's putting on a show trying to sell us. He doesn't realize that we need him more than he needs us. Now Shea went into his pitch. He told us that in exchange for a small fee, he'd gladly connect us with the very best factories in Taiwan. This had the potential to be big. We could use someone on the ground to pave our way, to make introductions, to help Gorman acclimate. An Asian Giampietro. We haggled over commission per pair for a few minutes, but it was a friendly haggling. Then we shook hands. Deal, deal. We sat down again and drew up an agreement to establish a Taiwan-based subcompany. What to call it? I didn't want to use Nike. If we ever wanted to do business in the People's Republic of China, we couldn't be associated with China's sworn enemy. It was a faint hope at best, an impossible dream, but still. So I picked Athena, the Greek goddess who brings Nike, Athena Corp. And thus I preserved the unmapped, unnumbered road to heaven, or a shoe dog's idea of heaven, a country with 2 billion feet. I sent Gorman home ahead of me. Before leaving Asia, I told him I needed to make one quick stop in Manila. Personal errand, I said vaguely. I went to Manila to visit a shoe factory, a very good one. Then, closing an old loop, I spent the night in MacArthur's old suite. You are remembered for the rules you break. Maybe, maybe not. It was the bicentennial year, that strange moment in America's cultural history, that 365-day Lollapalooza of self-examination and civics lessons and semi-nightly fireworks. From January 1st to December 31st of that year, you couldn't change the channel without hitting upon a movie or documentary about George Washington or Ben Franklin or Lexington and Concord. And invariably embedded in the patriotic programming, there would be yet another bicentennial minute, a public service announcement in which Dick Van Dyke or Lucille Ball or Gabe Kaplan would recount some episode that took place on this date during the Revolutionary Era. One night, it might be Jessica Tandy talking about the felling of the Liberty Tree. The next night, it might be President Gerald Ford exhorting all Americans to keep the spirit of 76 alive. It was all somewhat corny, a little bit sentimental, and immensely moving. The year-long swell of patriotism brought out an already strong love of country in me. Tall ships sailing into New York Harbor, recitations of the Bill of Rights and Declaration of Independence, fervent talk of liberty and justice. It all refreshed my gratitude about being an American, and being free, and not being in jail. At the 1976 Olympic trials, held again that June in Eugene, Nike had a chance, a marvelous chance, to make a good show. We'd never had that chance with Tiger, whose spikes weren't top caliber. We'd never had that chance with the first generation of Nike products. Now, at last, we had our own stuff, and it was really good. Top-quality marathon shoes and spikes. We were buzzing with excitement as we left Portland. Finally, we said, we're going to have a Nike shod runner make an Olympic team. It was going to happen. It needed to happen. Penny and I drove to Eugene, where we met up with Johnson, who was photographing the event. Despite our excitement about the trials, we talked most about Pri, as we took our seats in the packed bleachers. It was clear that Pri was on everyone else's mind, too. We heard his name coming from every direction, and his spirit seemed to hover like the low clouds rolling above the track. And if you were tempted to forget him, even for a moment, you got another bracing reminder when you looked at the runner's feet. Many were wearing pre-Montreals. Many more were wearing Exeter-made products like the Triumph and the Vancouver. Hayward that day looked like a Nike showroom. It was well known that these trials would have been the start of Pri's epic comeback. After being knocked down in Munich, he'd have risen again, no doubt, and the rising would have begun right here, right now. Each race prompted the same thoughts, the same images. Pri bursting ahead of the pack. Pri diving through the tape. We could see it. We could see him flush with victory. If only, we kept saying, our voices choking. If only. At sunset, the sky turned red, white, and a deep blackish blue. But it was still bright enough to read by as the runners in the 10,000 meters gathered at the starting line. Penny and I tried to clear our minds as we stood, hands clasped as if in prayer. We were counting on Shorter, of course. He was extremely talented, and he'd been the last person to see Pri alive. It made sense that he'd be the one to carry Pri's torch. But we also had Nikes on Craig Virgin, a brilliant young runner from the University of Illinois, and on Gary Bjorklund, a lovable veteran from Minnesota who was trying to come back from surgery to remove a loose bone in his foot. The gun went off, the runner shot forward, all bunched tight, and Penny and I were bunched tight too, oohing and aahing with every stride. There wasn't an inch of separation in the pack until the halfway mark, when Shorter and Virgin violently pushed ahead. In the jostling, Virgin accidentally stepped on Bjorklund and sent his Nike flying. Now Bjorklund's tender, surgically repaired foot was bare, exposed, smacking the hard track with every stride. And yet Bjorklund didn't stop. He didn't falter. He didn't even slow down. He just kept running, faster and faster, and that blazing show of courage won over the crowd. I think we cheered for him as loudly as we cheered for Pree the year before. Entering the final lap, Shorter and Virgin were in front. Penny and I were jumping up and down. "We're going to get two," we said. "We're going to get two." And then we got three. Shorter and Virgin took first and second, and Bjorklund plunged ahead of Bill Rogers at the tape to take third. I was drenched in sweat. Three Olympians in Nikes. The next morning, rather than take a victory lap at Hayward, we set up camp at the Nike store. While Johnson and I mingled with customers, Penny manned the silkscreen machine and churned out Nike t-shirts. Her craftsmanship was exquisite. All day long, people came in to say they'd seen someone wearing a Nike t-shirt on the street, and they just had to have one for themselves. Despite our continual melancholy about Pree, we allowed ourselves to feel joy that day, because it was becoming clear that Nike was doing more than making a good show. Nike was dominating those trials. Virgin took the 5,000 meters in Nikes. Shorter won the marathon in Nikes. Slowly in the shop, in the town, we heard people whispering, "Nike, Nike, Nike." We heard our name more than the name of any athlete, besides Pree. Saturday afternoon, walking into Hayward to visit Bowerman, I heard someone behind me say, "Geez, Nike is really kicking Adidas' ass." It might have been the highlight of the weekend, of the year, followed closely by the Puma sales rep I spotted moments later, leaning against a tree and looking suicidal. Bowerman was there strictly as a spectator, which was strange for him and us. And yet he was wearing his standard uniform, the ratty sweater, the low ball cap. At one point, he formally requested a meeting in a small office under the East Grandstand. The office wasn't really an office, more like a closet, where the groundskeepers stored their rakes and brooms and a few canvas chairs. There was barely room for the coach and Johnson and me, never mind the others invited by the coach, Hollister and Dennis Vixie, a local podiatrist who worked with Bowerman as a shoe consultant. As we shut the door, I noticed Bowerman didn't look like himself. At Pree's funeral, he'd seemed weak. Now he seemed lost. After a minute of small talk, he started bellowing. He complained he wasn't getting any respect anymore from Nike. We'd built him a home lab and supplied him with a lasting machine, but he said that he was constantly asking in vain for raw materials from Exeter. Johnson looked horrified. "What materials?" he asked. "I ask for shoe uppers and my requests are ignored," Bowerman said. Johnson turned to Vixie. "I sent you the uppers," he said. "Vixie, didn't you get them?" Vixie looked perplexed. "Yes, I got them." Bowerman took off his ball cap, put it back on, took it off. "Yeah, well," he grumbled, "but you didn't send the outer soles." Johnson's face reddened. "I sent those too." "Vixie?" "Yes," Vixie said. "We got them." Now we all turned to Bowerman, who was pacing, or trying to. There was no room. The office was dark, but I could still tell that my old coach's face was turning red. "Well, we didn't get them on time," he shouted, and the tines of the rakes trembled. This wasn't about uppers and outer soles. This was about retirement and time. Like Pree, time wouldn't listen to Bowerman. Time wouldn't slow down. "I'm not going to put up with this bullshit anymore," he huffed and stormed out, leaving the door swinging open. I looked at Johnson and Vixie and Hollister. They all looked at me. It didn't matter if Bowerman was right or wrong. We just have to find a way to make him feel needed and useful. "If Bowerman isn't happy," I said, "Nike isn't happy." A few months later, muggy Montreal was the setting for Nike's grand debut, our Olympic coming out party. As those 1976 games opened, we had athletes in several high-profile events wearing Nikes. But our highest hopes and most of our money were pinned on Shorter. He was the favorite to win gold, which meant that Nikes, for the first time ever, were going to cross an Olympic finish line ahead of all other shoes. This was an enormous rite of passage for a running shoe company. You really weren't a legitimate, full-fledged running shoe company until an Olympian ascended to the top medal stand in your gear. I woke up early that Saturday, July 31st, 1976. Right after my morning coffee, I took up my position in my recliner. I had a sandwich at my elbow, cold sodas in the fridge. I wondered if Kitami was watching. I wondered if my former bankers were watching. I wondered if my parents and sisters were watching. I wondered if the FBI was watching. The runners approached the starting line. With them, I crouched forward. I probably had as much adrenaline in my system as Shorter had in his. I waited for the pistol and for the inevitable close-up of Shorter's feet. The camera zoomed in. I stopped breathing. I slid out of my recliner onto the floor and crawled toward the TV screen. "No," I said. "No," I cried out in anguish. "No, no." He was wearing tigers. I watched in horror as the great hope of Nike took off in the shoes of our enemy. I stood, walked back to my recliner, and watched the race unfold, talking to myself, mumbling to myself. Slowly the house grew dark, not dark enough to suit me. At some point I drew the curtains, turned off the lights, but not the TV. I would watch all 2 hours and 10 minutes to the bitter end. I'm still not sure I know exactly what happened. Apparently, Shorter became convinced that his Nike shoes were fragile and wouldn't hold up for the whole 26 miles. Never mind that they'd performed perfectly well at the Olympic trials. Maybe it was nerves. Maybe it was superstition. He wanted to use what he'd always used. Runners are funny that way. In any case, at the last moment, he switched back to the shoes that he wore when he won the gold in 1972. And I switched from soda to vodka. Sitting in the dark, clutching a cocktail, I told myself it was no big deal in the grand scheme of things. Shorter didn't even win, and East German surprised him and took home the gold. Of course I was lying to myself. It was a very big deal, and not because of the disappointment or the lost marketing opportunity. If watching Shorter go off in shoes other than mine could affect me so deeply, it was now official. Nike was more than just a shoe. I no longer simply made Nikes. Nikes were making me. If I saw an athlete choose another shoe, if I saw anyone choose another shoe, it wasn't just a rejection of the brand alone, but of me. I told myself to be reasonable. Not everyone in the world was going to wear Nike. And I won't say that I became upset every time I saw someone walking down the street in a running shoe that wasn't mine. But it definitely registered. And I didn't care for it. At some point that night, I phoned Hollister. He was devastated, too. There was real grief in his voice. I was glad. I wanted people working for me who would feel that same burn, that same gut-punch rejection. Happily, there were fewer such rejections all the time. At the close of fiscal 1976, we doubled our sales, $14 million. A startling number, which financial analysts noted and wrote about. And yet we were still cash poor. I kept borrowing every nickel I could, plowing it into growth with the explicit or tacit blessing of people I trusted. Waddell, Strasser, Hayes. In early 1976, the four of us had talked tentatively about going public and tabled the idea. Now at the close of 1976, we took up the idea again, more seriously. We analyzed the risks, weighed the cons, considered the pros. Again, we decided no. Sure, sure, we said. We'd love to have that quick infusion of capital. Oh, the things we could do with that money, the factories we could lease, the talent we could hire. But going public would change our culture, make us beholden, make us corporate. That's not our play, we all agreed. Weeks later, strapped for money again, our bank accounts hovering at zero, we took another look at the idea and rejected it again. Wanting to settle the matter once and for all, I put the subject at the top of the agenda for our biannual gathering, a retreat we'd taken to calling the butt face. Johnson coined the phrase, we think. At one of our earliest retreats, he muttered, "How many multi-million dollar companies can you yell out, 'Hey, buttface,' and the entire management team turns around?" It got a laugh. And then it stuck. And then it became a key part of our vernacular. Buttface referred to both the retreat and the retreaters, and it not only captured the informal mood of those retreats, where no idea was too sacred to be mocked, and no person was too important to be ridiculed, it also summed up the company's spirit, mission, and ethos. The first few buttfaces took place at various Oregon resorts, Ottercrest, Salishan. Ultimately, we came to prefer Sun River, an idyllic spot in sunny central Oregon. Typically, Woodell and Johnson would fly out from the East Coast, and we'd all drive out to Sun River late Friday. We'd reserve a bunch of cabins, seize a conference room, and spend 2 or 3 days shouting ourselves hoarse. I can see myself so clearly at the head of a conference table, shouting, being shouted at, laughing until my voice was gone. The problems confronting us were grave, complex, seemingly insurmountable, but more so by the fact we were separated from each other by 3,000 miles, at a time when communication wasn't easy or instant. And yet we were always laughing. Sometimes after a really cathartic guffaw, I'd look around the table and feel overcome by emotion. Camaraderie, loyalty, gratitude, even love, surely love. But I also remember feeling shocked that these were the men I'd assembled. These were the founding fathers of a multi-million dollar company that sold athletic shoes. A paralyzed guy, 2 morbidly obese guys, a chain-smoking guy. It was bracing to realize that in this group, the one with whom I had the most in common was Johnson. And yet it was undeniable. While everyone else was laughing, rioting, he'd be the same one, sitting quietly in the middle of the table reading a book. The loudest voice at every buttface always seemed to be Hayes, and the craziest. Like his girth, his personality was always expanding, adding phobias and enthusiasms. For instance, by this time Hayes had developed a curious obsession with heavy equipment. Backhoes, bulldozers, cherry pickers, cranes, they fascinated him. They turned him on, there's no other way to say it. At an early buttface, we were leaving a local bar when Hayes spied a bulldozer in the field behind the lodge. He discovered, to his astonishment, the keys had been left inside. So he hopped in and moved the earth all around the field and in the parking lot, quitting only when he narrowly missed crushing several cars. Hayes on a bulldozer, I thought. As much as the swoosh, that might be our logo. I always said that Woodell made the trains run on time, but it was Hayes who laid down the tracks. Hayes set up all the esoteric accounting systems, without which the company would have ground to a halt. When we first went from manual to automated accounting, Hayes acquired the first primitive machines, and by constantly mending them, modifying them, or pounding them with his big hammy fists, he kept them uncannily accurate. When we first started doing business outside the United States, foreign currencies became a devilishly tricky problem, and Hayes set up an ingenious currency hedging system, which made the spread more reliable, more predictable. Despite our hijinks, despite our eccentricities, despite our physical limitations, I concluded in 1976 that we were a formidable team. Years later, a famous Harvard business professor studying Nike came to the same conclusion. Normally, he said, if one manager at a company can think tactically and strategically, that company has a good future. Half the buttfaces can do it. We had a kinetic mesh of strengths and weaknesses, skills and neuroses. Some of us were good with numbers, some were good with words, none was both. Undoubtedly, we looked to any casual observer like a sorry, motley crew, hopelessly mismatched. But in fact, we were more alike than different, and that gave a coherence to our goals and our efforts. We were mostly Oregon guys, which was important. We had an inborn need to prove ourselves, to show the world that we weren't hicks and hayseeds. And we were nearly all merciless self-loathers, which kept the egos in check. There was none of that smartest guy in the room foolishness. Hayes, Strasser, Woodell, Johnson, each would have been the smartest guy in any room, but none believed it of himself or the next guy. Our meetings were defined by contempt, disdain, and heaps of abuse. Oh, what abuse. We called each other terrible names. We rained down verbal blows. While floating ideas and shooting down ideas and hashing out threats to the company, the last thing we took into account was someone's feelings, including mine, especially mine. My fellow buttfaces, my employees, called me Bucky the Bookkeeper constantly. I never asked them to stop. I knew better. If you showed any weakness, any sentimentality, you were dead. I remember a buttface when Strasser decided we weren't being aggressive enough in our approach. Too many bean counters in this company, he said. So before this meeting starts, I want to interject something. I've prepared here a counter budget. He waved a big binder. This right here is what we should be doing with our money. Of course, everyone wanted to see his numbers, but especially the numbers guy, Hayes. When we discovered that the numbers didn't add up, not one column, we started howling. Strasser took it personally. It's the essence I'm getting at, he said. The essence, not the specifics. The howling grew louder. So Strasser picked up his binder and threw it against the wall. Fuck all you guys, he said. The binder burst open, pages flew everywhere, and the laughter was deafening. Even Strasser couldn't help himself. He had to join in. Little wonder that Strasser's nickname was Rolling Thunder. Hayes, meanwhile, was Doomsday. Woodell was Weight, as in dead weight. Johnson was Four Factor, because he tended to exaggerate, and therefore everything he said needed to be divided by four. No one took it personally. The only thing truly not tolerated at a buttface was a thin skin. And sobriety. At day's end, when everybody had a scratchy throat from all the abusing and laughing and problem-solving, when our yellow legal pads were filled with ideas, solutions, quotations, and lists upon lists, we'd shift ground to the bar at the lodge and continue the meeting over drinks. Many drinks. The bar was called the Owl's Nest. I love to close my eyes and remember us storming through the entrance, scattering all other patrons, or making friends of them. We'd buy drinks for the house, then commandeer a corner and continue laying into each other about some problem or idea or harebrained scheme. Say the problem was getting midsoles from point A to point B. Round and round we'd go, everyone speaking at once, a corral of name-calling and finger-pointing, all made louder and funnier and somehow clearer by the booze. To anyone in the Owl's Nest, to anyone in the corporate world, it would have looked inefficient, inappropriate, wasteful, even scandalous. But before the bartender gave last call, we'd know full well why those midsoles weren't getting from point A to point B. And the person responsible would be contrite and put on notice, and by God we'd have a creative solution. The only person who didn't join us in these late-night revels was Johnson. He'd typically go for a head-clearing run, then retreat to his room and read in bed. I don't think he ever set foot in the Owl's Nest, or knew where it was. We'd always have to spend the first part of the next morning updating him on what we decided in his absence. In the bicentennial year alone, we were struggling with a number of unusually stressful problems. We needed to find a larger warehouse on the East Coast. We needed to transfer our sales distribution center from Holliston, Massachusetts, to a new 40,000-square-foot space in Greenland, New Hampshire, which was sure to be a logistical nightmare. We needed to hire an advertising agency to handle the increasing volume of print ads. We needed to either fix or shut down our underperforming factories. We needed to smooth out glitches in our futures programs. We needed to hire a director of promotions. We needed to form a pro club, a sort of reward system for our top NBA stars, to cement their loyalty and keep them in the Nike fold. We needed to approve new products, like the Arsenal, a soccer baseball cleat with leather upper and vinyl polyfoam tongue, and the Striker, a multi-purpose cleat good for soccer, baseball, football, softball, and field hockey. And we needed to decide on a new logo. Aside from the swoosh, we had a lowercase script name, N-I-K-E, which was problematic. Too many people thought it was Like or Mike. but it was too late in the day to change the name of the company, so making the letters more readable seemed a good idea. Denny Strickland, creative director at our advertising agency, had designed a block-lettered N-I-K-E, all caps, and nested it inside a swoosh. We spent days considering it, debating it. Above all, we needed to decide once and for all this going public question. In those earliest butt faces, a consensus began to form. If we couldn't sustain growth, we couldn't survive. And despite our fears, despite the risks and downsides, going public was the best way to sustain growth. And yet in the midst of those intense discussions, in the middle of one of the most trying years in the company's history, those butt face meetings were pure joy. Of all those hours spent at Sun River, not one minute felt like work. It was us against the world, and we felt damn sorry for the world. That is, when we weren't righteously pissed off at it. Each of us had been misunderstood, misjudged, dismissed, shunned by bosses, spurned by luck, rejected by society, shortchanged by fate when looks and other natural graces were handed out. We'd each been forged by early failure. We'd each given ourselves to some quest, some attempt at validation or meaning, and fallen short. Hayes couldn't become a partner because he was too fat. Johnson couldn't cope in the so-called normal world of 9-to-5. Strasser was an insurance lawyer who hated insurance and lawyers. Waddell lost all his youthful dreams in one fluke accident. I got cut from the baseball team, and I got my heart broken. I identified with the born loser in each butt face and vice versa, and I knew that together we could become winners. I still didn't know exactly what winning meant, other than not losing, but we seemed to be getting closer to a defining moment when that question would be settled, or at least more sharply defined. Maybe going public would be that moment. Maybe going public would finally ensure that Nike would live on. If I had any doubts about Blue Ribbon's management team in 1976, they were mainly about me. Was I doing right by the butt faces, giving them so little guidance? When they did well, I'd shrug and deliver my highest praise. Not bad. When they erred, I'd yell for a minute or two, then shake it off. None of the butt faces felt the least threatened by me. Was that a good thing? Don't tell people how to do things. Tell them what to do and let them surprise you with their results. It was the right tack for Patton and his GIs, but did that make it right for a bunch of butt faces? I worried. Maybe I should be more hands-on. Maybe we should be more structured. But then I'd think, whatever I'm doing, it must be working because mutinies are few. In fact, ever since Bork, no one had thrown a genuine tantrum about anything, not even what they were paid, which is unheard of in any company, big or small. The butt faces knew I wasn't paying myself much, and they trusted that I was paying them what I could. Clearly the butt faces liked the culture I'd created. I trusted them wholly and didn't look over their shoulders, and that bred a powerful two-way loyalty. My management style wouldn't have worked for people who wanted to be guided every step, but this group found it liberating, empowering. I let them be, let them do, let them make their own mistakes, because that's how I'd always liked people to treat me. At the end of a butt-face weekend, consumed with these and other thoughts, I'd drive back to Portland in a trance. Halfway there, I'd come out of the trance and start thinking about Penny and the boys. The butt faces were like family, but every minute I spent with them was at the cost of my other family, my real family. The guilt was palpable. Often I'd walk into my house and Matthew and Travis would meet me at the door. "Where have you been?" they'd ask. "Daddy was with his friends," I'd say, picking them up. They'd stare, confused. "But Mommy told us you were working." It was around this time, as Nike rolled out its first children's shoes, Wally Waffle and Robbie Road Racer, that Matthew announced he would never wear Nikes so long as he lived. His way of expressing anger about my absences, as well as other frustrations. Penny tried to make him understand that Daddy wasn't absent by choice. Daddy was trying to build something. Daddy was trying to ensure that he and Travis would one day be able to attend college. I didn't even bother to explain. I told myself it didn't matter what I said. Matthew never understood, and Travis always understood. They seemed born with these unvarying default positions. Matthew seemed to harbor some innate resentment toward me, while Travis seemed congenitally devoted. What difference would a few more words make? What difference would a few more hours make? My fatherhood style, my management style. I was forever questioning, is it good or merely good enough? Time and again, I'd vow to change. Time and again, I'd tell myself I will spend more time with the boys. Time and again, I'd keep that promise for a while. Then I'd fall back to my former routine, the only way I knew. Not hands off, but not hands on. This might have been the one problem I couldn't solve by brainstorming with my fellow butt faces. Vastly trickier than how to get midsoles from point A to point B was the question of Son A and Son B, how to keep them happy while keeping Son C, Nike, afloat. 1977. His name was M. Frank Rudy. He was a former aerospace engineer, and he was a true original. One look at him told you he was a nutty professor, though it wasn't until years later that I learned the full extent of his nuttiness. He kept a meticulous diary of his sex life and bowel movements. He had a business partner, Bob Bogert, another brainiac, and they had a crazy idea, and together they were going to pitch us. That's the sum total of what I knew that morning in March 1977 as we settled around the conference table. I wasn't even sure how these guys reached us or how they'd arranged this meeting. "Okay, fellas," I said, "what have you got?" It was a beautiful day, I remember. The light outside the room was a buttery pale yellow, and the sky was blue for the first time in months, so I was distracted, a little spring feverish, as Rudy leaned his weight on the edge of the conference table and smiled. "Mr. Knight, we've come up with a way to inject air into a running shoe." I frowned and dropped my pencil. "Why?" I said. "For greater cushioning," he said, "for greater support, for the ride of a lifetime." I stared. "You're kidding me, right?" I'd heard a lot of silliness from a lot of different people in the shoe business, but this, oh, brother. Rudy handed me a pair of soles that looked as if they'd been FedExed from the 22nd century. Big, clunky, they were clear, thick plastic, and inside were bubbles? I turned them over. "Bubbles?" I said. "Pressurized airbags," he said. I set down the soles and gave Rudy a closer look, a full head-to-toe. 6'3", lanky, with unruly dark hair, bottle-bottom glasses, a lopsided grin, and a severe vitamin D deficiency, I thought. Not enough sunshine, or else a long-lost member of the Adams family. He saw me appraising him, saw my skepticism, and wasn't the least fazed. He walked to the blackboard, picked up a piece of chalk, and began writing numbers, symbols, equations. He explained at some length why an air shoe would work, why it would never go flat, why it was the next big thing. When he finished, I stared at the blackboard. As a trained accountant, I'd spent a good part of my life looking at blackboards, but this Rudy fella's scribbles were something else. Indecipherable. "Humans have been wearing shoes since the Ice Age," I said, "and the underlying design hasn't changed all that much in 40,000 years. There hadn't really been a breakthrough since the late 1800s, when cobblers started lasting left and right shoes differently, and rubber companies started making soles. It didn't seem all too likely that, at this late date in history, something so new, so revolutionary, was going to be dreamed up. Air shoes sounded to me like jetpacks and moving sidewalks, comic book stuff." Rudy still wasn't discouraged. He kept at it, unflappable, earnest. Finally, he shrugged and said that he understood. He'd tried to pitch Adidas, and they'd been skeptical, too. The magic words. That was all I needed to hear. I asked if I could fit his air soles into my running shoes and give them a try. "They don't have a moderator," he said. "They'd be loose and wobbly." "I don't care about that," I said. I squeezed the soles into my shoes, slipped the shoes back on, laced them up. "Not bad," I said, bouncing up and down. I went for a 6-mile run. They were indeed unstable, but they were also one heck of a ride. I ran back to the office. Still covered with sweat, I ran straight up to Strasser and told him, I think we might have something here. That night, Strasser and I went to dinner with Rudy and Bogert. Rudy explained more of the science behind the air soles, and the second time around, it started to make sense. I told him there was a possibility we could do business. Then I turned it over to Strasser to close. I'd hired Strasser for his legal mind, but by 1977, I discovered his true talent, negotiating. The first few times I asked him to work out a contract with sports agents, the toughest negotiators in the world, he more than held his own. I was amazed. So were the agents. Every time, Strasser walked away with more than we'd ever hoped. No one scared him. No one matched him in a battle of wills. By 1977, I was sending him into every negotiation with total confidence, as if I were sending in the 82nd Airborne. His secret, I think, was that he just didn't care what he said, or how he said it, or how it went over. He was totally honest, a radical tactic in any negotiation. I recall one tug-of-war Strasser had over Elvin Hayes, the Washington Bullets All-Star, whom we badly wanted to sign again. Elvin's agents told Strasser, "You should give Elvin your whole damn company." Strasser yawned. "You want it? Help yourself. We've got 10 grand in the bank." "Final offer. Take it or leave it." The agent took it. Now, seeing great potential in these air soles, Strasser offered Rudy 10 cents for every pair of soles that we sold, and Rudy demanded 20, and after weeks of haggling, they settled somewhere in the middle. We then shipped Rudy and his partner back to Exeter, which was becoming our de facto research and development department. Of course, when Johnson met Rudy, he did exactly what I'd done. He slipped some air soles into his running shoes and trotted 6 brisk miles, after which he phoned me. "This could be huge," he said. "That's what I thought," I said. But Johnson worried that the bubble would cause friction. His foot felt hot, he said. He had the start of a blister. He suggested putting air in the midsole as well to level out the ride. "Don't tell me," I said. "Tell your new roommate, Mr. Rudy." Fresh off the successful closing with Rudy, we gave Strasser another critical assignment. Sign college basketball coaches. Nike had a solid stable of NBA players, and sales of basketball shoes were rising briskly. But we had virtually no college teams, not even the University of Oregon. Unthinkable. The coach, Dick Harder, told us in 1975 that he'd left the decision up to his players, and the team vote was 6-6, so the team stayed with Converse. The next year, the team voted for Nike, 9-3. But Harder said it was still too close, so he was staying with Converse. What the? I told Hollister to lobby the players steadily over the next 12 months, which he did. And the 1977 vote was 12-0 for Nike. The next day I met Harder in Jaqua's office, and he told us he still wasn't ready to sign. "Why not?" "Where's my $2,500?" he said. "Ah," I said, "now I get it." I mailed Harder a check. At last my Ducks would wear Nikes on the hardboards. At almost this same odd moment in time, a second strange shoe inventor showed up on our doorstep. His name was Sonny Vaccaro, and he was just as unique as Frank Rudy. Short, round, with constantly darting eyes, he spoke in a soupy voice with an Americanized Italian accent, or an Italianized American accent, I couldn't place it. He was a shoe dog for sure, but a shoe dog straight out of The Godfather. When he first arrived at Nike, he carried with him several shoes of his own invention, which set off gales of laughter around the conference room. The guy was no Rudy. And yet in the course of conversation, he claimed to be chummy with every college basketball coach in the country. Somehow, years before, he'd founded a popular high school all-star game, the Dapper Dan Classic, and it was a big hit, and through it, he'd gotten to know all the coaching royalty. "Okay," I told him, "you're hired. You and Strasser hit the road. Go out and see if you can crack that college basketball market." All the great basketball schools, UCLA, Indiana, North Carolina, and so on, had long-standing deals with Adidas or Converse. So, who was left? And what could we offer? We hurriedly dreamed up an advisory board, another version of our pro club, our NB8 reward system, but it was small beer. I fully expected Strasser and Vaccaro to fail, and I expected to see neither of them for a year at least. 1 month later, Strasser was standing in my office, beaming and shouting and ticking off names. Eddie Sutton, Arkansas, Abe Lemons, Texas, Jerry Tarkanian, UNLV, Frank McGuire, South Carolina. I leaped out of my chair. McGuire was a legend. He'd defeated Wilt Chamberlain's Kansas team to win the national championship for North Carolina. We hit pay dirt, Strasser said. Plus, almost as a throw-in, he mentioned two under-the-radar youngsters, Jim Valvano at Iona and John Thompson at Georgetown. A year or two later, he did the same thing with college football coaches, landing all the greats, including Vince Dooley and his national champion Georgia Bulldogs. Herschel Walker in Nikes. Yes! We rushed out a press release announcing that Nike had these schools under contract. Alas, the press release had a bad typo. Iona was spelled Iowa. Lute Olson, coach at Iowa, phoned immediately. He was irate. We apologized and said we'd send a correction the next day. He got quiet.
Well, no, wait, he said. What's this advisory board anyway?
The Harder rule in full effect. Other endorsements were a greater struggle. Our tennis effort had started so promisingly with Nastase, but then we'd hit that speed bump with Connors, and now Nastase was dumping us. Adidas had offered him $100,000 a year, including shoes, clothes, and rackets. We had the right to match, but it was out of the question. Fiscally irresponsible, I said to Nasty's agent and anyone else who would listen. No one will ever see a sports endorsement deal that big ever again. So there we were in 1977 without a horse in tennis. We quickly hired a local pro to be a consultant, and that summer he and I went to Wimbledon. On our first day in London, we met a group of American tennis officials. We've got some great young players, they said. Elliot Telcher may be the best. Gottfried is also outstanding. Whatever you do, just stay away from the kid playing on court 14. Why? He's a hothead. I went straight to court 14 and fell madly, hopelessly in love with a frizzy-haired high school kid from New York City named John McEnroe. At the same time we were signing deals with athletes and coaches and nutty professors, we were coming out with the LD1000, a running shoe that featured a dramatically flared heel. The heel flared so much, in fact, that from certain angles it looked like a water ski. The theory was that a flared heel would lessen torque on the leg and reduce pressure on the knee, thus lowering the risk of tendonitis and other running-related maladies. Bowerman designed it with heavy input from Vixie the podiatrist. Customers loved it. At first. Then came the issues. If a runner didn't land just right, the flared heel could cause pronation, knee problems, or worse. We issued a recall and braced ourselves for a public backlash, but it never came. On the contrary, we heard nothing but gratitude. No other shoe company was trying new things, so our efforts, successful or not, were seen as noble. All innovation was hailed as progressive, forward-thinking. Just as failure didn't deter us, it didn't seem to diminish the loyalty of our customers. Bowerman, however, got very down on himself. I tried to console him by reminding him that there was no Nike without him, so he should continue to invent, create fearlessly. The LD1000 was like a literary genius's novel that didn't quite come together. It happened to the best of them. No reason to stop writing. My pep talks didn't work. And then I made the mistake of mentioning the air sole we had in development. I told Bowerman about Rudy's oxygenated innovation, and Bowerman scoffed. Air shoes, that'll never work, Buck. He sounded a bit jealous. I considered it a good sign. His competitive juices were already flowing again. Many afternoons, I'd sit around the office with Strasser trying to figure out why some lines were selling and some not, which led to broader discussions of what people thought of us and why. We didn't have focus groups or market research. We couldn't afford them. So we tried to intuit, divine, read tea leaves. Clearly people liked the look of our shoes, we agreed. Clearly they liked our story, Oregon firm founded by running geeks. Clearly they liked what wearing a pair of Nikes said about them. We were more than a brand, we were a statement. Some of the credit went to Hollywood. We had a guy out there giving Nikes to stars, all kinds of stars, big, little, rising, fading. Every time I turned on the TV, our shoes were on a character in some hit show, Starsky and Hutch, the $6 million man, the Incredible Hulk. Somehow, our Hollywood liaison got a pair of Señorita Cortezes into the hands of Farrah Fawcett, who wore them in a 1977 episode of Charlie's Angels. That was all they took. One quick shot of Farrah and Nikes, and every store in the nation was sold out of Señorita Cortezes by noon the next day. Soon the cheerleaders at UCLA and USC were jumping and leaping in what was commonly called the Farrah shoe, all of which meant more demand and more problems meeting demand. Our manufacturing base was broader. Besides Japan, we now had several factories in Taiwan and two smaller factories in Korea, plus Puerto Rico and Exeter, but still we couldn't keep up. Also, the more factories we brought online, the more strain it put on our cash. Occasionally, our problems had nothing to do with cash. In Korea, for instance, the five biggest factories were so massive and the competition among them so cutthroat, we knew we were going to get knocked off soon. Sure enough, one day I received in the mail a perfect replica of our Nike Bruin, including the trademark swoosh. Imitation is flattery, but knockoff is theft, and this theft was diabolical. The detail in the workmanship without any input from our people was startlingly good. I wrote the president of the factory and demanded he cease and desist, or I'd have him thrown in jail for 100 years. And by the way, I added, how would you like to work with us? I signed a contract with his factory in the summer of 1977, which ended our knockoff problem for the moment. More important, it gave us the capacity to shift production in a huge way, if need be. It also ended once and for all our dependence on Japan. The problems were never going to stop, I realized, but for the moment, we had more momentum than problems. To build on this momentum, we rolled out a new ad campaign with a sexy new slogan, "There is no finish line." It was the idea of our new ad agency and its CEO, John Brown. He'd just opened his own shop in Seattle, and he was young, bright, and of course, the opposite of an athlete. That was all we seemed to hire in those days. Besides Johnson and myself, Nike was a haven for the sedentary. Still, non-jock or not, Brown managed to dream up a campaign and a tagline that captured Nike's ethos. His ad showed a single runner on a lonely country road surrounded by tall Douglas firs. Oregon, clearly. The copy read, "Beating the competition is relatively easy. Beating yourself is a never-ending commitment." Everyone around me thought the ads were bold, fresh. They didn't focus on the product, but on the spirit behind the product, which was something you never saw in the 1970s. People congratulated me on that ad as if we'd achieved something earth-shattering. Not bad, I'd say, shrugging. I wasn't being modest. I still didn't believe in the power of advertising. At all. A product, I thought, speaks for itself, or it doesn't. In the end, it's only quality that counts. I couldn't imagine that any ad campaign would ever prove me wrong or change my mind. Our advertising people, of course, told me I was wrong, wrong, 1,000% wrong. But time and again I'd ask them, "Can you say definitively that people are buying Nikes because of your ad? Can you show it to me in black and white numbers?" Silence. "No," they'd say, "we can't say that definitively." "So then it's a little hard to get enthused," I'd say, "isn't it?" Silence. I often wished I had more time to kick back and debate the niceties of advertising. Our semi-daily crises were always bigger and more pressing than what slogan to print under a picture of our shoes. In the second half of 1977, the crisis was our debenture holders. They were suddenly clamoring for a way to cash in. By far the best way for them to do so would be a public offering, which, we tried to explain to them, was not an option. They didn't want to hear that. I turned once more to Chuck Robinson. He'd served with distinction as lieutenant commander on a battleship in World War II. He'd built Saudi Arabia's first steel mill. He'd helped negotiate the grain deal with the Soviets. Chuck knew business cold, better than anyone I'd ever met, and I'd been wanting his advice for quite some time. But over the last few years, he'd been the number two man under Henry Kissinger at the State Department, and thereby off-limits to me, according to Jaqua. Now, with Jimmy Carter newly elected, Chuck was on Wall Street and available once again for consultations. I invited him out to Oregon. I'll never forget his first day in our office. I caught him up on the developments of the last few years and thanked him for his invaluable counsel about Japanese trading companies. Then I showed him our financial statements. He flipped through them, started to laugh. He couldn't stop laughing. "Compositionally," he said, "you are a Japanese trading company. 90% debt." "I know. You can't live like this," he said. "Well, I guess that's why you're here." As the first order of business, I invited him to be on our board of directors. To my surprise, he agreed. Then I asked his opinion about going public. He said going public wasn't an option, it was mandatory. "I needed to solve this cash flow problem," he said. "Attack it, wrestle it to the ground, or else I could lose the company." Hearing his assessment was frightening, but necessary. For the first time ever, I saw going public as inevitable, and I couldn't help it. The realization made me sad. Of course, we stood to make a great deal of money, but personal gain had never factored into my decisions, and it never mattered to the Buttfaces. So when I brought it up at the next meeting and told them what Chuck had said, I didn't ask for another debate. I just put it to a vote. Hayes was for. Johnson was against. Strasser, too. "It'll spoil the culture," he kept saying, over and over. Waddell was on the fence. If there was one thing we all agreed on, however, it was the lack of barriers. Nothing stood in the way of going public. Sales were extraordinary. Word of mouth was positive. Legal disputes were behind us. We had debt, but for the moment, it was manageable. At the start of the 1977 Christmas season, as the brightly colored lights appeared on the houses in my neighborhood, I recall thinking during one of my nightly runs, "Everything is about to change. It's just a matter of time." And then came the letter. An unimposing little thing, standard white envelope, embossed return address, U.S. Customs Service, Washington, D.C. I opened it and my hands started to shake. It was a bill for $25 million. I read it and reread it. I couldn't make heads or tails. As best I could determine, the federal government was saying that Nike owed customs duties dating back 3 years by virtue of something called the American selling price, an old duty assessing method. American selling what? I called Strasser into my office and thrust the letter at him. He read it, laughed. "This can't be real," he said, tugging his beard. "My reaction exactly," I said. We passed it back and forth and agreed it had to be a mistake. Because if it was real, if we actually did owe $25 million to the government, we were out of business, just like that. All this talk of going public had been a colossal waste of time. Everything since 1962 had been a waste of time. There is no finish line. This right here, this is the finish line. Strasser made a few phone calls and came back to me the next day. This time he wasn't laughing. "It might be real," he said. And its origin was sinister. Our American competitors, Converse and Keds, plus a few small factories, in other words, what was left of the American shoe industry, were all behind it. They'd lobbied Washington, D.C. in an effort to slow our momentum, and their lobbying had paid off better than they'd ever dared hope. They'd managed to convince customs officials to effectively hobble us by enforcing this American selling price, an archaic law that dated back to the protectionist days, which preceded, some say prompted, the Great Depression. Essentially, the American Selling Price Law, or ASP, said that import duties on nylon shoes must be 20% of the manufacturing cost of the shoe, unless there's a similar shoe manufactured by a competitor in the United States.